I have Sonny Osborne on the phone. How you doing today, Sonny?
I'm doing okay.
Well, good, good. Did you catch Kentucky and that high school team they played last night?
I saw a little bit of it when they got 50 some points ahead. I had something else to do. I'll watch them any time though, because I just love the whole idea of Kentucky basketball. Always have. But that was such a mismatch. I mean, they shouldn't schedule games like that. I know why they do it. They do it for the opposing team so they can get a great payday.
Right.
But, you know what, that makes those kids, don't you know, those kids just feel terrible.
Well, I would think so. Yeah, Lafayette, whoever they were, yeah, they were outmanned, and you know, it's something to say that if UK goes on and does as well as it did last year, you can say you played on a team that played against the national champion, I guess, and raised some money for your school.
Well, yeah, that's right too, and I don't think it does the Kentucky players one bit of good playing a game like that, because it gives them a false impression that they're doing a lot better than they are, really.
Yeah, that's right.
You put some good competition up there, and they can't do the stuff they did last night.
Yeah, you're right. I grew up like you did, probably listening to UK and Rupp and all those guys, and it's just something that's part of you.
I don't remember him scheduling games like that.
No,
though.
No, he did not. You're right.
I just don't remember that.
Of course, a lot of the SEC was kind of like that back in those days, basketball-wise.
Well, yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah, they weren't the powerhouse they are now. They were in football, but not in basketball back in those days.
I love that statement that Rupp made. Somebody asked him about, didn't he really teach defense? And he said, if you know it from this, why do you need to play defense?
What was that game? Now we're way off topic here. What was that game where they, it was an important game against a real opponent, and he yelled at the guy for allowing two points in the second half? And I can't.
Oh, yeah. Well, they went into the locker room at halftime, and the score was something like 36-3. And number 8, I think, is what the guy stuck to. Well, first statement was, hey, who's guard number 8? That guy's killing him.
That's it. That's the one. Oh, man. Hey, next.
I seem like that was the Ralph Beard and Groza, Jim Lyon. That was that late 40s team.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, that's when they really started their run, yeah.
Oh, man.
Hey, next week we're going to try, and heck, that'll be the Saturday after Thanksgiving. I'm trying to hook you in with Bill Evans if I can work some kind of magic, and Bill's going to be on right before you. Maybe we can overlap a little bit, and you guys can all talk about stuff. That'd be fun if I can work it, if I can do the magic on this end.
Bill's a good guy. One of my partners in the
Venture
Camp.
Yeah.
And a good teacher and a good player, understands a lot more about the instrument than most of us do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I'm looking forward to that, and I got until Saturday to figure out how to do it. I haven't figured out how to get a conference call, but I'll get it done. So we'll have Bill on, then we'll fold over into you for a while, and then Bill can go on about his business, is what I figure.
Well, I hope you can figure it out.
I will somehow. Hey, sent you a message this week. Last week we talked about fiddles and fiddle players, and touched a little bit on Benny Martin, and I thought, well, you know, guitar has changed a lot from your time starting out in bluegrass, certainly till now, as far as rhythm becoming a lead instrument, and then I also thought of Jimmy Martin, and I know you felt strongly about his rhythm guitar, but I thought we could talk a little bit about the place of guitar in bluegrass, how it's changed, I guess, with I don't know if the most common breaking point, I guess, in people's mind was Clarence White changing the role of a guitar, but when you started out and you were doing bluegrass in a band setting, the guitar, what role did it play, and who did you think was the best at doing that?
Just a guitar was a rhythm instrument, and it should have stayed a rhythm instrument, in my mind anyway. I never did like the thought of a guitar being a lead instrument because your rhythm absolutely goes to the dogs when that guy takes a break on the guitar. And Clarence White had the name of doing it, but Tony Rice, as far as playing a really just a good, meaningful guitar, Tony Rice was awfully good, and still is for that matter.
Oh, yeah.
But then he learned from Clarence, and I understand that. Understand that well, but it's just like Earl, maybe he learned from Snuffy Jenkins or whomever, but Snuffy Jenkins didn't have what Earl had, and the same thing that I didn't think Clarence had what Tony Rice had. But
well, Tony took it to Tony popped all those jazz chords in there and all that different. When he was on his own and doing with man, you know, his Tony Rice unit and some of the stuff that he did. It was a different sounding guitar, but I guess maybe the approach of a lot of notes as opposed to just banging rhythm, maybe that's what he started with Clarence.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. To me, though, a guitar in a bluegrass band should be a rhythm instrument, something that's just like a bass. It should be a rhythm instrument and something to carry the load of that rhythm while the lead guys, the mandolin and the fiddle and the banjo play. Take their breaks and play the lead. It's just like I said, when the guitar plays lead, then the rhythm really suffers, and I don't like that. When you're producing, like producing records, and the guitar guy takes a break, everything else quiets down. And that, it just makes a, to me, it makes a bad record, but that's just my opinion. A whole lot of people don't look at it that way. But I have that right. I do.
You do. And you're not just saying it because you're a banjo player. You talk about the sound of the whole band coming down and the rhythm being derailed, I guess because the guitar is so much quieter than
Yeah. Lester Merrill kind of proved that the way Flat played rhythm guitar, he kind of proved where the guitar's place was. That was a good rhythm guitar player. I would rate him probably the best ever as far as rhythm guitar playing goes. Jimmy Martin was good until, oh goodness, I guess maybe 1956 or 7. When he started, and I don't mean to sound bad about this, but he started to read his press with him, and when he started doing that, he started doing more single strain stuff on the guitar instead of playing a good solid rhythm, which was what he did so well. When Jimmy Bobby and I worked together in 53, August of 54 to August of 55 is when that was. We played together for that year. There was none better. He was as good as a rhythm guitar player as you could ever ask for, ever. But then after that, people started saying, well, he did the Uncle Pen run and all like that. Well, if you listen to the Uncle Pen run, the Uncle Pen run was nothing compared to what Jimmy did later. I mean, it was just another rhythm lick, kinda. But Jimmy was awfully good at what he did until about 1950, maybe 6 or 7, right in there somewhere. I know that we played someplace long after we broke up, and Jimmy came and played on the stage with us, and he was nowhere near the guitar player that he had been. But that's just the way guys see things. He made a great living at it, and what can you say? Probably the best rhythm guitar players that we had in all the time was probably Dale Sled and Paul Brewster was a good rhythm guitar player. Paul Brewster, Terry Eldridge was a good guitar player. Those three, though, stand out. And the other guys, just stop playing the other guys like Ronnie Reno and guys like that, were not good. They were, but they were not. I'll tell you, Dan Cupp was a good guitar player.
Oh, okay.
Dan Cupp was a good rhythm guitar player. He worked with Jimmy for a few years, a couple of years or something like that, and he learned that wrist, the right wrist, that Jimmy had. He learned how to do that, and Dana Cook was a good rhythm guitar player.
He often listens to the show. As a matter of fact, he usually pops into this little chat room about the time he thinks you're coming on. So if Dana's out there, you know, that was a nice little... Oh, yeah, Dana Cupp always listens.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah, almost all the time.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, you're worldwide. I tell you all the time, you're worldwide. But Dana a lot of times will pop into the chat room when you're talking, and it's hard for me to chat with him because I got my hands holding the phone and everything else, but he pops in around, so.
Well, Dana's a good guy, good friend. I haven't seen him in a little while, but he's okay. He could flat out play a rhythm guitar, though. He could do that. But those four guys, I guess, were tops. Denny Burchfield was a good guitar player. He was fast. He had a real quick right arm, but he played too hard. He's kind of, you can take a really good instrument, and if you play it too hard, you take away the good that's in that instrument. You absolutely don't. What you do is you kill the instrument before it has time to do what it is built to do. Evangelist the same way, Madeline the same way, and a guitar is just terrible like that. If you beat a guitar too hard, it really takes away from the tone. And defeats the purpose is really what it does. A lot of banjo players play extremely hard, and it's not necessary. If you've got a good banjo, you don't have to play hard at all. And let the banjo do what it intended to do, what it's built to do. But a lot of guys don't do that.
You know, Bill Emerson, I don't know who was, it might have been him or it might have been Tom Adams, was explaining that Bill doesn't play hard or loud at all until he needs that little extra boost, but for the most part, he's not playing hard. That you remember that?
Emerson?
Yeah.
No, Bill didn't, he never played hard. He never played hard.
But on the records though, it sounds like he's just tearing. And even when you see him, but he's not. He's using the instrument like you said. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I mean that's the one thing I notice about recordings that Bill does. And when you see him live, but actually he's not playing hard.
Well, you've got a $2,000 mic there in front of you.
Yeah,
that's really doing a lot of work too. But Emerson's a great banjo player. And he never played hard. There's such a thing as playing too easy. Also, Ralph Stanley, to me, played too easy. By playing easy, I'm talking about playing soft.
Right.
You could stand close to Ralph when he was at his best, really, like in the early 50s, late 40s, and it was hard to hear him, really. And some guys are like that. I notice a lot of the melodic players, chromatic players, whatever they call, I don't know one from the other. But when they do a lot of notes, like Don Reno used to do with a flat pick. And anyway, a lot of them, they don't get a lot of volume out of the banjo. They don't get a good tone. As good a tone, I'll say it that way. Bill Keith has got a good tone out of the banjo to be playing chromatic style of banjo playing. Cooper and Bela Fleck. Now, this is my opinion only, and nobody should say, well, he said this, or, you know, it's not that way. This is just my opinion, what I'm saying. Bela Fleck's banjo always sounded real bassy sounded, coarse sounded, real, like a thud more than a note. Now, a lot of people don't look at it that way, but I sure do.
You think that's because he plays so far up away from the bridge or something else?
Of course, that's what it is. Now, I noticed that banjo camp, Kristen, her banjo, she played the old three that she's got, the old three, part of the time, and then she played the cheap part of the time. And both of them sounded the same. They had the real, like the head is just really, really too loose. And I've talked to her a dozen times about that, and it always comes right back to the same thing, that the banjo sounds like that, and I don't know why. I don't know why it sounds that way. One time, Kenny Ingram, when he worked for Lester Flatt, this is in the 70s, I guess it was, Kenny had a, I can't remember, it seemed like it was a 3, but I don't remember what it was. But anyway, he brought it to me, and he said, man, this thing is not sounding good. You reckon you can work on it a little bit? I said, sure. So I took it to my room that night, and I can't remember what it was. I took it to my room, and the head was just spongy, and that's how the banjo sounded. It sounded spongy. And so I tightened the head up and adjusted the bridge a little bit, and I thought it sounded, I gave it back to him the next day, I thought it sounded just wonderful. Had a real good crack and pop to it. And that was like around 2 o'clock in the afternoon that I gave him the banjo back to where we went to play that night. I noticed his banjo sounded the same as it had been sounded. And he didn't like it to sound the way I set it up, so he went and loosened the head up, like real loose. It just sounded spongy. So I just got to thinking, you know, maybe that's the way the guy hears it. That's the way he wants it to be, and that's the way he hears it. And so probably up to me to step in and say anything about it. But I go on how I think they're supposed to sound, and they're supposed to have a bright crack, a pop to them. But a lot of guys don't think that. So.
Well, if he came to because he wasn't happy with that spongy sounding head, then what do you think he was looking for?
I don't know. I've asked myself that a dozen times, and I have no idea. I don't know what he wanted, and I still don't. Kenny's playing the banjo now that I recorded Roll Muddy River with. It's a bigger.
Oh, yeah.
And, it's just, I mean, there's none other like it. And I had it built, I guess, about 1966. I played it for a couple of 67 maybe. I played it for a couple of years, and I think we recorded Roll Muddy River in 66, so that's when I got it. And I played that banjo for me until 1970, but then I just thought, well, I'm not going to do this anymore. So I put it in the case, and Kenny asked me, I might have told you this. Kenny asked me about it, and I said, Kenny, I don't even know where that banjo is. I really don't. And he said, well, if you find it, I'd sure like to play it a little bit. And I ran it down, found it, and it had been in the case 40 years, I guess it was.
Wow.
And, he's had it about a year, maybe a little over a year now. And he absolutely loves that badger. And but it's got a bright sound to it.
Well, that's what I saw him. Larry Stevenson was up this way, I guess, in the earlier this year, and I talked to Kenny about that banjo, and it's nothing spongy about it at all.
No, that thing is bright. I mean, just and he just loves it. I don't know if it that he loves the tone of it or what it is. And I'm not saying pat myself on the back or anything like that, but he looks at it as a like a piece of history, that's a historical value. But I don't look at it that way.
He guards it like it's a live child.
I know. I told him to. I said, you play this as long as you want to, but I don't want nobody touching this statue.
That's what he said.
I've had guys come up to me and say, boy, I just reached over and touched that thing. He pressed it away from my hand. And that's what I told him. And, that's what I wanted to be done.
Well, that's the message. Nobody gets near it. And if Kenny's standing in front of it, there aren't many people that are going to try to get him out of the way either.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you know the Grasskulls are playing in Clay City, Kentucky today.
Oh, they are. You know that? I did not know that.
You didn't know that.
I didn't know that. See, that's why you got to keep me abreast of those things. I didn't know that. Of course,
so
I'm
sitting around over there at Clay City. I used to love to play there.
Yeah, it's a good place.
Yeah. So, how's it going with you?
Going good. Just been busy keeping up with this and, scheduling new things and trying to arrange who's going to do what when and how this show's going to go. And, I make this stuff up as I go along. There was no manual with it. People say, what are you going to do? I said, whatever I feel like doing until they tell me not to do it anymore, I guess. But
Have you been lawing anybody?
I've been lawing some people. Yeah, I've been after some people. I got some new stuff coming in. It's a shame to say that, the business is good when things are bad for people. They're in a bad spot, but you try to help them out. So,
yeah. Every time I see the red light or the blue light, I guess now on a cop's car, I just get to thinking, boy, he really messed that guy's day up bad.
That's a horrible feeling. And I tell you the truth, I don't do much criminal stuff anymore because I did so much of it on both sides. I kind of set that aside. But every once in a while, someone will call me as a favor. I'll get involved. But that ruins your whole day when the lights go on behind you.
Yeah, I try to put myself in that place, and I don't think I could honestly do that because I would look at a guy in the face and think, "Boy, that old boy, he needs help." and no matter what he done, I'd try to help him a little bit. And
well,
times I think that guy there, he needs to be put away.
Well, even though having been on that inside of that law enforcement thing, there's no quota, there's a quota. They'll tell you exactly when they have to do it, but they'll never tell you there's a quota for tickets, but there's a quota, and they all know how much they have to do each month, and if they're late on a certain day, they'll write 30 that day.
Yeah, that's the truth right there. And they can, if you drive 10 miles, you'll break the law.
They call them fishbowls. When they're behind, they know where to go, and they call them a fishbowl, and they just sit there, and the people zip by, and they ride them till their pen wears out. That's the truth. That's the truth.
I'm sure. I know it is. I've been on the receiving end of that a couple times too.
Hey. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Now, I was going to ask you, you were mentioning Jiminy Martin, and not Jiminy Martin, that's the guy that was Disney, that was the cricket, Jimmy Martin. Where's Jimmy Martin and the Osmond Brothers, that album you did with him, and I know how much for that five-year period that you thought Jimmy was just as solid a rhythm player as you can, but I also know that you have some stories that we could share over the air, about your dealings with Jimmy. I don't need the stuff where things went bad, but people love to hear you talk about the times on the road and the people you were with, and if there's a couple you can pull out, that's fine. If not, we'll go on to something else.
You can't talk too much about Jimmy on there.
Well?
You really can't. Most of the time that we were together, Jimmy is so intense. I mean, his whole being was just nothing but focus on music, nothing else, just focus on music and him. I mean, and Jimmy loved himself a great deal, and I'm not saying that as a put down, but he just did. A lot of people do. but you got to draw the line somewhere. And Jenny was very, very, very intense. And I just never looked at it that way. I always tried to have fun with it, with music itself. And you try to do something a little bit off the wall, like with Jenny, and he would say something to you about it. That's not good. You'll not be doing that right there. And the way I looked at it, he played the guitar and I played the banjo, and I told him that a dozen or so times, probably days more than that even, that as long as I played the banjo, I was going to play the banjo, and then he should concentrate on the guitar and try to make it as good as he can. And but he, and then he'd take offense to that. Jimmy was he was a different dude. That's all there is to it. He was different. It's just hard to say much of anything. Especially once you don't get into some things that probably
Well, here's a question I have for you, and I've heard different people that played with him. That when you're talking about, he would tell you how to play the banjo, and he told other people how to play their instrument, and he would say, not like this, like this, and then they would play the same thing. Was that just a matter of control for him, or was he really hearing something different from play this lick like that, and when it was identical? You know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you mean. There was a young man that came to me. Oh, my gosh, I can't remember that boy's name. But we had played somewhere in Kentucky, maybe Louisville or someplace like that, with him. And we were in, we must have walked it or something like that the next day. And Jimmy was on that show, too. And this guy came to me at the Kentucky day. And after he was done, and he told me, he said, you know what? He said, I just can't do this much anymore, because he said, he's on to me all the time, play it this way. And he said, I just can't play it that way. And I told him, I said, you know what? Why don't you just play what you've been playing? And just do that, and don't change anything, but just do that. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, just listen to what he says. Say, I understand exactly, and I'll try to do it that way. And then I said, then just get on the stage and play how you feel. That's the only way you're going to be able to play the banjo, just play how you feel. And so the next day in Wisconsin, this boy came to me and he was laughing. He said, it worked like a charm.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, when we got done in Louisville, or wherever it was, and he said, Jimmy just climbed all over me. Play it this way. Play this song this way. And play this song this way. And he said, what a whole show like that. And I said, I'll try the best I can. And he said, well, we got to the date. No, this was, you know what? It was 2 days before. That's what it was. Anyway, they had played a date between. And Jimmy had climbed all over him. And he said, when we got to the date, it's in North Carolina is where it was. He said, when we got to the date, I just played what I normally play. And after it was over, I asked him, I said, was that any better? And he said, Jimmy looked at him and he just smiled and said, that was as good as you've ever played right there. And he played the same thing that he had been playing. And I knew a long time ago that Jimmy just, he wanted to be credited with a lot of things that he wasn't able to do. I wrote a tune after I had been with Bill Monroe the first time, and Jimmy was the guitar player. I wrote a tune called Sunny Mountain Chimes.
Yeah.
and supported it. And the thing sold, I don't know, 80,000 records, I think is what they said it sold. And that's unheard of. For a little label out of Cincinnati from just nowhere. And so the next year, or the next summer, well, I quit school in March, and I went back to work with Bill. And Gene was still with him. And one night we got to talking about it, he said, "I always told you we needed something with chimes in it." You know, and I said, "Jimmy, that's an absolute lie." And I said, "You never said it about that." He said, "I always said that, sport. I always told you that." And I said, "That's an absolute straight out lie." And but he wanted credit. And he would pick up the banjo and with two fingers, no pick, a thumb and a finger, and he would play notes. He said, "Play it this way, sport. Play it this way.
Play it this way, sport."
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's in part of a sport. And, you know, and it was impossible to play what he was playing because he was playing with two fingers. And I wasn't going to do it anyway. I would have not played it. If I would have liked what he played, I wouldn't have played it that way. And not to be defiant or anything, but I just wouldn't have done it. And I told him one night, I said, "Jimmy," and this was in Michigan now, in Pontiac, Michigan. And we had played that night, and we're on the way to Burlington, North Carolina. And we were going to play that whole next week down there, and then go back to Detroit Saturday. And we left Pontiac, and he started in on the way I played a certain tune on the banjo. And he said, "You don't just keep doing stuff like that to make us sound just like Western Earl." And I told him, I said, "Jimmy, if just by chance I could ever happen to do the things that he's doing, Earl's doing with his right hand, I would play that way forever." And I said, "I will struggle and really try to do it that way. I don't care what you say. What you need to do is take care of the guitar." And oh, we got into a tremendous argument about that I was playing too much like Earl. And I just kept thinking, boy, I wish my people felt that way. I'd like to be able to play that good. And oh, I was... that was in 54, so I was 16, 17 years old. And Jimmy resented the fact that I was 17 and argued with him. Mm. He was 27. And he resented that real bad, that I was arguing with him. And he said, "I'm not going to let no 17-year-old kid tell me." And I said, "Jimmy, I'm not trying to tell you anything. I'm just saying to you that I'm going to play the banjo. You play the guitar." Oh, we argued. I guess till we got from Detroit to almost Toledo. No, Michigan. That's where it was. He was in the back seat. No, he was in the front seat in the passenger side. Bobby was driving. Had a 53 Buick, super. Bobby was driving. And I said, "Dude, I'm really tired of talking about this. Oh, dude, you know what? You ain't getting out of it that easy." And he just kept getting a little more heated. And finally, I told Bobby, I said, "Bobby, listen, pull this car over here right to the side of the road, and we'll get done with this, and then I can go to sleep back here." Dude said, "Oh, no, Lord." He said, "No, I'm not going to do that." If I wanted to fight, he said, "I'd go to New York and get in the ring and fight." And I said, "They won't do, you know what?" Oh, my gosh.
A 17-year-old.
Yeah, that's what he said, yeah. Mm.
What was the, You got, what were you together for, what, a year or more than a year with Jimmy Martin and the Osmond Brothers?
Yeah, the brothers and Jimmy were together a year from August the 5th, I think it was, 1953 till August the 5th, 1954. No, it's August 5th, 1954 to August the 5th, 1955. We were together and played in Detroit in WJR radio, 50,000 watt station, and also did a radio TV show on Friday at CKLW in Windsor, Ontario. It was a good show. Casey Clark and the Lazy Lance Boys had the show, and they played on the air what would they call that, WJR Barn Dance or something like that. And then after that was done, then they took, they had cleared all the chairs away, and they did a dance. Then they played it till whatever time, midnight or 1 o'clock or something like that. And boy, you can learn a whole lot playing the banjo when you play for dances, a square dance like that. A whole lot.
What do you mean as far as what?
We played for 15 or 20 minutes straight. You know.
Oh, okay. One song. I see what you're saying, to keep the dance going.
Yeah.
Hey, what was the? Go ahead.
No, that's all right.
What was the? What was then the? This thing with Jimmy and you and Bobby were in the band. When did that end? Why and why? I know when it ended. You just told me, but what was the breaking point? I guess.
We had recorded on RCA Victor as Jimmy Martin and the Osmond Brothers and had some success with it. And we played Pontiac, I guess it was. I don't remember exactly the place we played. But it was a little bit out of Detroit. And I walked into the restroom, and Jimmy and Bobby were in there, and Jimmy said, your boy's name probably won't be on the next records. And I just told him, I said, well, then there won't be any more records then, because we're not going to do that. And he said, well, I told Bob. I said, I don't care what you told Bob. I said, if our name is not on those records, we're not going to be any more records. Not as with us on it anyway. And he said, and he brought up that kid again, that teenage kid. He said, I'm certainly not going to let a teenage kid tell me what I can do, what I can't do. I said, Jimmy, I'm not trying to do that. Only thing I'm telling you is that if we're on those records, our name's going to be on it, and if our name is not on the records, then we won't make the records. And he said, well, why don't you get your own band to lead it? I said, you know what? I think we'll do that. That's exactly what I think we'll do. And that was August, July. That was probably the last week of July of 1955. And so, and Jimmy said, his boys just don't like the way I'm leading. I said, Jimmy, honest to goodness, I said this to him, and I thought later, somebody said it to me, I'd hit him, I think. I said, Jimmy, if you were to lead a bunch of animals to a river, they wouldn't know how to drink. And when you get that broke down and try to think about it, it don't make any sense.
Well, it doesn't really, but I guess you were angry today.
No. Don't make any sense at all, but he got mad over that too, really mad over that. And I said, in a week we'll be out of here. We're leaving. And Bobby didn't want, I don't think he wanted to go. He might have, I'm not sure about that. But we decided that we was gonna leave, and we went to work with Charlie Bailey. Let's see, we left Detroit in August. And in September, we went to work with Charlie Bailey at Wheeling. And the next April then, we got on MGM Records. And we just went from there. And there was no more RCA Records. I guess they didn't record him, you know, by himself. I just don't know what happened there.
Do you remember why he decided you weren't going to be on the record cover anymore listed? What was that all about?
I have no idea.
Huh.
I have no idea. It was a successful situation. We were making good money, and everything was going good. The records were selling good. There were good records, too. Well-balanced, good records. And the, you know what? Those songs that we recorded right then, I think we made six sides, I believe. Those songs right now, if you listen to them, they still hold up. Still. That music is still good. Mm-hmm. And Bobby, Jimmy, and I together were pretty good. I mean, and I'm not big-headed or anything like that, but we did some good work together.
Yeah.
I don't know what his problem was. Maybe it was that he wanted all the recognition. Maybe he wanted it to be just him. He wanted the bus keys, maybe. I don't really know. I have no idea.
He wanted the bus keys?
Huh?
You said he wanted the bus keys?
Yeah, well, by that I mean he wanted to be the boss.
Oh, I see. Okay, all right. That makes more sense than the animals in the water thing. I just missed it.
Yeah, well, the animals in the water, that just, as I got thinking about that, it made no sense at all. He just got totally tore up about that. I mean, it really did.
Well, you hit a sore spot with him, that's all. The animals in the water, that was the breaking point.
But otherwise, I didn't respect him as a leader. I guess that's the way he took it.
Yeah.
I didn't. I really didn't at all. We had a good time in Detroit and worked there a year, and it was pretty good. And I enjoyed the time with Jimmy, but I was sure glad when it was over. And Bobby and I did okay for ourselves.
Yeah, I'd say so. That's good. And you enjoyed being up in Detroit during that time, didn't you? After you kind of got established.
Oh yeah, I really liked Detroit a great deal at that time. I don't know how it would be now. I've heard some awfully bad things about Detroit now, how it is, but I know back then it was really nice. I enjoyed it a great deal. Yeah. It's a huge place, and you had to map out how to get from one side of town to the other, and I really liked that.
Hmm.
I enjoyed it.
Good, that's good. All right, I'm going to, we're about ready to get out of here, and I will, hey, listen, happy Thanksgiving coming up.
Thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody, and be thankful for what we have, and do the best we can with it.
All right. Hey, man, I appreciate you calling in. Well, I'll hook you up with Bill Evans next time, and we'll figure some other stuff. I'm sure Bill will help me come up with some good things to talk about.
Okay, do that.
Take care. Take it easy, Sonny. Thanks, man. Bye.